You are listening to Making Waves, Fresh Ideas in Freshwater Science. Making Waves is a bi-monthly podcast where we discuss new ideas in freshwater science and why they matter to you. Making Waves is brought to you with support from the Society for Freshwater Science.
Hello, I'm your podcast host, Erin Larson, with the Society for Freshwater Science, and my guest today is Amanda Sobolewski, a postdoc with the Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies. Welcome to the podcast, Amanda. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So to start with, I was wondering if you could tell us briefly about your research and what makes you so excited about it.
I'm broadly interested in the way that animal movement and behavior can influence whole ecosystem function. And I study this in a river in East Africa, the Mara River, and I'm interested in the role of large wildlife in transporting carbon and nutrients from the terrestrial landscape into the aquatic system and what that does to the river ecosystem.
Awesome. What got you started working in the Mara?
I had a background as a wildlife ecologist, and I was getting more interested in understanding what wildlife behaviors do to the ecosystems that they live in. And after I finished my master's research, I sought out an opportunity to work more in river ecosystem function. And I worked for a project at Florida International University studying environmental flows in the Mara River. And one of the key things that I found when I was working there was that the large wildlife had a really important influence on the river ecosystem, and we would actually see remarkable declines in water quality as the river entered the region where the wildlife were, which was opposite of what we expected. We expected to see the river kind of maybe impacted by human presence, but then recover once it entered the protected areas. And what we saw instead was what we think of as traditional indicators of water quality declined when the river entered the protected areas. And this seemed pretty clearly linked to the influence of large wildlife, and so I decided that I wanted to study that in more detail.
Awesome. And so what were some of those indicators of water quality that you saw declining when you entered the reserve?
Turbidity goes up, so the amount of dirt in the river, suspended solids. Conductivity goes up, which is often considered an indication of pollutant load or contaminant load in the water. And dissolved oxygen goes down pretty remarkably, particularly when the flow levels decline, which we've now linked to the settling and decomposition of hippo feces on the bottom of the river.
Oh, cool. Interesting. So you had a recent study out, too, in addition to your studies on hippos, looking at wildebeest drownings and how they influence the river ecosystem function in the Mara. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that study and how that came about.
Yeah. There has been, of course, the Pacific salmon work is famous work studying the influence of animal carcasses in river ecosystems, but there aren't a lot of natural river ecosystems anymore where this happens, where you see the large abundance of animal carcasses in the river. And early on when I started working in the Mara, we would see occasionally rafts of wildebeest carcasses piled on the banks of the river. And it struck me as really unique and a really exciting opportunity to investigate what the influence of large ungulate carcasses could be in a river system. And the Mara is particularly unique because we have these two different forms of animals moving resource subsidies into the river system. You have hippos, which are doing this daily feeding migration and feeding in the grasslands and then defecating and urinating in the river every day. And that's one kind of input and probably has certain kinds of ecosystem effects. But then you have this occasional periodic pulse of wildebeest carcasses going into the river during these mass drowning events. And it seemed like a really unique opportunity to study these two different forms of input and what they do to the system.
What was the most surprising thing you think you found during your wildebeest study? Was there something that, you know, did you expect to find a certain impact that they had on the river and then saw a different impact? Or what was the most surprising result you think you found?
Yeah, well, two things. I would say first, I approached it seeing the wildebeest inputs as this kind of, as I said, a pulse input in time that was there. And after a few weeks, you don't see the carcasses anymore. They appear to be gone. Mm-hmm. But what we found through doing decomposition studies was that actually half of the weight, the dry mass of a wildebeest carcass is bone, and that's where 95% of the phosphorus in the carcass is. And those bones decompose over years.
Wow.
So even though the carcass to our visible eye at the surface of the water is gone after a few weeks or maybe months, the bones stay in the system for years. And because these mass drownings happen almost every year by the thousands, there's an incredible bed of bones at the bottom of the river, presumably slowly leaching out phosphorus into the system and calcium over time. So actually, these periodic carcass inputs, I think, are much longer in their influence and their temporal influence on the river ecosystem.
That's super interesting. I was really interested to read when I read that paper, too, that you actually see biofilms growing on the bones, mm-hmm. and that that's something that then fish are eating as well. I'd never really thought about bones as being substrate for biofilms. As a stream ecologist, I'm like, oh, yeah, rocks, the substrate, wood, all sorts of other types of detritus potentially can be substrates for biofilms. And it was really interesting to see that bones can actually play that role as well.
But I will say the second thing that I found very surprising, and we're still trying to tussle with actually a bit, is so far with our measurements of biofilm growth and respiration on tiles and at the whole river level, we haven't really picked up an effect of wildebeest drownings and carcass inputs on what we think of as whole ecosystem function. Mm-hmm. So we don't actually see an increase in production or respiration in the at the river ecosystem mm-hmm. level, even when there are thousands of carcasses in the river.
Wow.
And this is really surprising and is a bit of a mystery for us and kind of is setting the stage for, our next stage of research in the system.
Yeah.
To understand that.
Yeah, I'm surprised by that. I would think that ecosystem metabolism would really change as a mm-hmm. result of those inputs.
And I think part of why it doesn't is because it's a river that already has 4,000 hippos defecating in it every day. And so it's about the context in which these carcass inputs are entering the river system.
Right. And so do you think in some ways potentially those hippo inputs might be – I was curious to see, and I think it's really interesting to think about this idea of, like, there's these daily migrations, and then you have these maybe not so much pulse now that you're thinking about these bones decomposing for long periods of time. But do you think that one type of input might be more important for ecosystem function than another? Or how do you think about the balance – I guess that's – the future direction is thinking about the balance of those two types.
Yeah. And one thing I will say is, I say that when you see a bunch of carcasses into the river, we don't see a response in ecosystem metabolism. But, and certainly my first interpretation of that was, oh, wow, maybe carcasses don't matter when you have so much hippo loading because mm-hmm. it's such a massive scale of loading. But another interpretation of that is that the wildebeest carcasses always matter, and because their bones are always there, and maybe the bones play a significantly large role, that whether the actual fresh carcasses is there or not doesn't matter, because the bones are kind of always playing this role in fertilizing the system.
Right. Yeah, that's super interesting. Super cool. What was one of the most challenging parts of that study? It seems like in general, working in such an interesting area and with large animals, like, I'm sure there's plenty of challenges. What was the hardest part in doing the wildebeest study?
The hardest part is that they're fairly stochastic events. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. they're difficult to predict when they're going to happen. You need a crossing happening at a certain crossing point when the river is a certain level. And so you can't really plan your research around when a drowning is going to happen. Yeah. You have to be a little bit opportunistic mm-hmm. and to take advantage of it. And on the other hand, one might not happen for months. So you kind of have to have other research going on that you're willing then to drop at a moment's notice when a drowning happens. And that was difficult. And then on a more practical side, litter bags turned out to be pretty difficult to do because we put out carcass litter bags.
Right, yeah.
Spent days, preparing them so carefully and weighing every little piece and then put them out to come back the next day and find that crocodiles and Nile monitors had, plucked off about half of our carcass litter bags overnight.
No.
And they just thought we'd put out little goodie bags for them. So we had to then go get a big metal cage welded in town and redeploy litter bags inside of a cage.
Wow. How big were – so I'm not sure. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with litter bags, these things that you put leaves into to decompose – well, often leaves to decompose in streams and then measure decomposition rates. But it's funny in my mind to think about a litter bag full of wildebeest. So did you take just different parts of the wildebeest and put them in, small bags?
Yeah.
Like how big were these?
They were small. We used small bags. They mm-hmm. were maybe 10 by 10, centimeters, and used different parts of the carcass. Although my advisor has consistently pushed me to do a whole carcass litter bag. We haven't worked out the logistics of how we will pull it out of the river to reweigh it on a regular basis.
Yeah, that seems like it would be.
It's a matter of discussion.
A very difficult thing to do. So obviously research has its challenges, but also it can be super enjoyable. So what do you feel like was the most fun part of the wildebeest drowning study? What was, I'm sure there are many highlights, hopefully, but what really did you feel like was the most fun part of doing that study?
I mean, I love field work and the field work of it, you know, to count the, although the, I will say the drownings are these tragic events that happen, you know, and that's something that once, especially once we first witnessed our first drowning actually happening, that's kind of not lost on you, that it is this really tragic, like, on an individual scale, loss of life. But the ecological response to it is really beautiful, and it's this exciting response of life to this input of resources from death. And surveying that was really cool. So we would hire armed rangers to walk the riverbanks, because riverbanks are actually kind of a dangerous place to be in sub-Saharan Africa. And we didn't have a lot of other opportunities to do those kinds of walks. And so we would walk, you know, these 5-kilometer stretches surveying carcasses and counting crocodiles and counting vultures. And that was just really exciting to be able to engage with the river in that way.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Something we take for granted in North America, where you can easily walk riverbanks, but they're harder to do in Kenya.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. I hadn't really thought about that as the riverside as being a really dangerous place to be working.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of your hippo work as well. I really found your study interesting, where you went and looked at hippo ingestion and excretion in a zoo setting where it's easier to measure things like that, and then also translated that into thinking about hippo effects on the Mara. So what was it like to actually work with captive hippos after you've seen them in their natural habitat? I'm just curious, like, what that felt like, what that was like.
Yeah, it was really fun, because hippos in their natural setting are really dangerous and intimidating animals, although I love them and find them charming. You know, they're always kind of watching them with one very cautious eye, and of course you never want to be close to them. And in the zoo, you know, each of them had names, and we got to feed them apples, you know, through the cage, obviously. Right. But it was really fun to kind of get to engage with hippos in that different, in a different way, in a more friendly way.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And it's interesting to think about, you know, it was interesting to read that paper and realize, it would be really hard to measure hippo excretion and ingestion in the wild. And, you know, I work on insects and fish and smaller things where you can do that, and it's easy to, you know, take them out of the stream and put them in a bucket or a bag or whatever and do those types of measurements. And it's interesting to think about zoos as a place where you can do that type of research, especially with large animals, where you really couldn't do that in the wild.
Yeah. Yeah, and I owe that inspiration to J.J. Weiss, who was a lab member of mine at the time, and and people in my lab have measured nutrient excretion from fish by putting them in kind of a container and measuring the water before and after. And I was bemoaning that this would be difficult to find a container big enough for a hippo. And JJ said, you know, the Milwaukee County Zoo hippo exhibit would be perfect for this, actually. And the folks at the zoo were really keen to be engaged. They thought it was interesting, and they were happy to have people help shovel out the hippo pool.
I know. I loved the description in your methods of wheelbarrows just full of elephant, of hippo poop.
Yeah.
It was just really, it's just such a different scale to work and think about rivers on compared to, I think, those of us who work in either North America or South America or a lot of other rivers where you just don't have these large animals that play an important, huge role in ecosystem function.
I will say where we don't have them anymore.
Yeah, that's true. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. Like, I found it really interesting in your wildebeest study when you talked about this idea that bison probably historically played a really big role in the North American landscape and rivers. And I was curious to hear your take on that and what you think, how you think that reframes your what you think about rivers and other places that historically had these large migrations.
Yeah, it's something I'm still learning a lot about, and I learned a lot about working on the wildebeest paper. You know, I found records talking about huge drownings of thousands of carcasses recorded by early explorers, suggesting that this happened on a, maybe even close to annual basis, you know, fairly regular observations of this happening. And it's incredible to me to think that we had, maybe near 30 million bison in the western United States 250 years ago. I mean, that's not long. You know, I'm accustomed to thinking about, like, you know, Pleistocene megafaunal extinctions, and that was 10,000 years ago, which in evolutionary timescales and ecological timescales even is, you know, it's not that long ago.
Right.
But it's still a long time.
Yeah.
But the idea that 250 years ago only we might have had regular inputs of large drownings in our rivers is really interesting to me, and it suggests that the rivers that we see now and what we think of as reference streams and reference conditions for rivers maybe is a shifted baseline from what it was not that long ago.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about. I just finished reading Undaunted Courage, actually, about the Lewis and Clark expedition. Uh-huh. It was interesting to read some of their and hear more about the things that they observed when they saw when they were the white men seeing the western U.S. Mm-hmm. for the first time. And to just think about how different those systems look now in such a short time scale. It's definitely something important to keep in mind as ecologists when we think about, you know, what is sort of normal or baseline for a certain system, to really think that things have undergone big changes in not a very long amount of time. Mm-hmm. So what research are you really excited to do next in the Mara or elsewhere potentially? What are sort of the next steps that you'd really like to take in your research?
Well, we have a fair amount of data showing that these wildlife inputs have a really important effect on the river food web, but we're still trying to understand the pathways through which those enter the food web, and I think that there's probably multiple pathways and that probably varies seasonally, and I think there's some exciting work to be done there, understanding the influence of subsidy form and magnitude on secondary production. I also think that there's really interesting biogeochemical cycling happening within these hot spots of wildlife loading, because animals tend to aggregate in time and space, and we see that with the hippo inputs in these hippo pools and with the carcass inputs, because carcasses they happen at crossings, and then the carcasses aggregate at rocks and river bends. You get these aggregations of different sizes, and we see that the size of the input, the concentration of the input, influences kind of the fate of the nutrients in the system. But we have a lot of work to do, I think, to understand how that influences the actual biogeochemical cycling of those inputs, and I think that's really exciting. And then I think that, you know, we've done a lot of work to understand the arrows going from the grassland into the river, mm-hmm. and it would be cool to do some more work understanding the arrows going back out to the grasslands. And we've started to do that a bit with avian scavengers,
right.
and found that that's a really substantial transport back to the grasslands, but I also imagine through aquatic insect emergence and probably some other interesting terrestrial animal vectors like hyenas and mongoose, that there's some other really interesting pathways to study.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting to think about the whole food web effect of these carcasses. Do you see like peaks in insect emergence, or do you see fish aggregations around those big carcass buildups at all?
Anecdotally, yes, although we haven't measured it. Mm-hmm. But you'll see fish feeding. You know, you can see the activity under the water.
Right.
Fish, crocodiles, Nile monitors coming in and really focusing on those aggregations. And one of the interesting phenomena we have observed is that about 2 weeks-ish after the carcasses, you know, after the drowning has occurred, you'll see big blooms of maggots in the river.
Oh, interesting.
And you actually can put a net in the water and scoop out maggots, because so many are floating downstream.
Everyone's favorite type of field work.
Because the carcasses have just been colonized by so many insects.
Yeah.
And we have some work that we're working on publishing right now, looking at scavenger succession on the carcasses, which is mostly terrestrial scavengers, because mm-hmm. that's what it's been easier to see these game cameras mm-hmm. to observe that. And we see these really interesting succession patterns, where first you get smaller you have vultures coming in, marabou storks, then you start to get near the latter parts, sacred ibis and mongoose, which are feeding on the insects that have colonized the carcasses. And so I think there's just some really interesting stories to be told there.
Yeah, that's awesome. We'll be looking forward to hearing what comes next for sure. So one of the things that we're starting to do a little bit more on the Making Waves podcast is to also talk about the scientists behind the science a little bit. And so I was curious to ask you some questions about you as a scientist. So did you always know you wanted to be a scientist, or what was your path towards becoming an ecologist?
I call it the scenic route. I didn't always know that. I knew that I loved being outside, mm-hmm. And I still love being outside. That's kind of what I like to do. I think it just took me a while to really realize that that could be my career, be being outside and learning about the natural world. So I started thinking maybe I wanted to go into medical school, be a doctor, and so I was a biology major, and that first gave me some experience doing field research. But it took me a while doing field research and doing my master's to kind of find what I felt was my place in the field.
Well, I'm glad you made it here. You're definitely an inspiration to many of us. And what do you like to do when you're not doing science? What do you do in your free time?
Well, like I said, I like to be outside, so mm-hmm. Going hiking or fishing or being on water. I also now have a daughter, a 2.5-year-old Aww. Daughter, so, doing things with her and kind of introducing her to the outdoors, and she loves to be outside, too. This is actually her second field season in the Mara this past year, so she really loves to be outside, so that's been fun. It's a whole new opportunity to learn about and experience the natural world through her eyes.
That's great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Amanda. It's been great to hear more about your research, and we're looking forward to hearing about what comes next.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. And again, this has been your podcast host, Erin Larson, with the Making Waves podcast, joined by Amanda Sobolewski. You've been listening to the Making Waves podcast, brought to you with support by the Society for Freshwater Science. For more info on the speaker, the Making Waves podcast, or the Society in general, please visit us on the web at the Society for Freshwater Science webpage. Tune in next time for another fresh idea in freshwater science.